The Civil Justice Subcommittee will come to order. Julia, please call the roll.
Chair Robinson.
Here.
Vice Chair Snyder.
Here.
Ranking Member Arrington.
Here.
Representatives Beltran.
Here.
Black.
Here.
Campbell. Chamberlain.
Here.
Daniels. Here. Gant has been excused. Coster.
Here.
Lopez.
Here.
Maggard.
Here.
Maney.
Here.
McFarland.
Here.
Overdorf.
Yes, ma'am.
Roth.
Here.
Saroy.
Here.
Smith.
Here.
A quorum is present, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Julia. I'd like to remind everyone to please silence their cell phones. As a reminder for our members, please ensure that you turn your microphone on when you're speaking and off when you are finished. And I just noticed Representative Joseph is joining us today to our fun little group here. So welcome to the Civil Justice Subcommittee. Members, today we will have a panel discussion on the offer of judgment statute. Our panelists today are the following: Attorney Megan Peek Luca of the Newsom Melton PA Law Firm, Attorney Braxton Gillum of the Millam Howard Nicardi and Gillum Law Firm, Attorney Kurt Alexander of the Rigdon Alexander and Rigdon Law Firm, and finally Attorney James Gassheimer of the Bergender Seigman Law Firm. Ms. Megan Lucan will now present a PowerPoint on Section 768.79, also known as the PFS statute, with a panel discussion following. Please give our panelists your full attention, and please hold any questions until the conclusion of the discussion, time permitted. Ms. Luca, you are recognized.
So I have been charged with giving you a primer on the proposal for settlement statute. I'm going to try to keep it at the 101 level, but I will make two disclaimers. The first one is I went to law school because I'm good with words, not numbers. So everything in this presentation is going to be small, simple numbers for my benefit mainly. And number two, I could teach a class for an entire semester about this statute and scratch the surface of it. So it's hard to give you a primer in 30 minutes. I will do my best. And my goal at the end is that none of you have a migraine. So I promise I've tried. It's still gonna feel like you're taking a sip of water from a fire hose though. So brace yourselves. And I hope everyone's caffeinated. So 1986, the Florida legislature creates a statute as a means to help resolve litigation. And I'm gonna give you some lingo. The statute is called offer of judgment / demand for judgment. There is a corollary Florida rule of civil procedure. It is called proposals for settlement. All three of those things, we're talking about the same vehicle. People call it an OJ, offer of judgment, even when it's a demand for a judgment, or a PFS for short. Regardless of the acronym, an offer of judgment is when a defendant is making an offer to a plaintiff to resolve the case. A demand for judgment feels kind of aggressive. If y'all are gonna change things, maybe a request for judgment. But demand for judgment is when a plaintiff is requesting from the defendant that they resolve the case. A proposal for settlement, it doesn't matter who's offering what. Again, we're all the same thing. I'm gonna call it an offer because that's what the statute calls it and it's easier. I might slip into proposal. I just want you to know we're talking about the same thing. Regardless of the acronym, the statute says you only have to have four things. It has to be in writing and say that it's being made pursuant to this section, because there are three other sections in the Florida statutes that allow for a similar vehicle. For instance, in eminent domain proceedings, you can make an offer to resolve the case, and if it's not accepted, there can be a punishment. So you have to say it's being made pursuant to 768.79. You have to name the party who's making it and the party to whom it's being made. You have to state with particularity whether you are making an offer to settle punitive damages, if there is a punitive damages claim, and you have to state the total amount. The legislature saw this as a simple path. A party serves an offer, the other side gets 30 days to chew on it and decide whether they want to accept it. If they change their mind after they serve the offer, no problem. Party can serve a written retraction of it, essentially. I've changed my mind, I retract the offer, now it's dead, it can't be accepted. If the other side doesn't accept and there is no retraction, now they've exposed themselves to the penalty of having to pay fees. The penalty is that you have to pay fees and costs that were incurred after the date the offer was served if you meet a financial threshold. So when the defendant makes an offer to the plaintiff, and the statute says that if the plaintiff's judgment obtained, which is a defined term, we'll talk about it in a minute, is 25% less than the offer the defendant made, then basically the statute's idea is, plaintiff, you should have accepted the offer. The court should have never had to deal with this. So you're going to be punished by having to pay the defendant's fees and costs that were incurred after the date the defendant made the offer you should have accepted. It works similarly when the plaintiff makes the offer. If the plaintiff makes the offer to the defendant and the plaintiff's judgment obtained is 25% greater than the offer, the idea is, defendant, you would have been better off taking this offer. It would have been cheaper for you. The court wouldn't have wasted time and money. You should have accepted it. Therefore, the punishment is that you have to pay the plaintiff's fees and costs that they incurred after the date that they served the offer you should have accepted. Depending on how early the offer is made, you could be talking about thousands of dollars, or in some cases, high-end, like tobacco cases, products liability cases, patent disputes, you can be talking about millions. The concept is to incentivize people to accept reasonable offers. If the offer isn't reasonable, if the defendant makes a lowball offer and the plaintiff is thinking, I can beat that by 25% every day of the week and twice on Sunday, it's not going to be accepted and it's not going to be a big deal. The point was to get some skin in the game for the parties. When they make reasonable offers, then the other side really has to approach it with trepidation if they're going to reject it. And if nothing else, a reasonable offer at least opens a dialogue about whether or not the case can be resolved. Sounds easy, right? Not so much. There's a corresponding rule of civil procedure that is designed to implement the statute. It adds a few requirements. You have to wait 90 days until after the case was filed before you can serve an offer. You have to serve it at least 45 days before the first day for which the case is set for trial. So you can't wait until the eve of trial to serve this offer. It has to state that it will resolve all damages that would otherwise be awarded in a final judgment. The idea being you have to resolve the entire case. You can't have a complaint that has three counts and offer to resolve one count. You have to be offering to resolve all of the counts against the party to whom the offer is being made. And it has to state whether it includes attorney's fees and whether they are part of the legal claim. In some instances, you might have, for example, a contract dispute where the contract says that the prevailing party is entitled to fees. In that case, when you write out your complaint, you say, I'm also demanding the fees I'm entitled to under the contract. In tort cases, basically any case where someone is injured, there is no entitlement to fees, so you just have to say, this proposal doesn't include attorney's fees because attorney's fees are not part of the legal claim. It used to be that you could include non-monetary terms, and the only limit was the creativity of the parties. So in a breach of contract case, you could include your money damages and a demand for an apology letter. Defendants often wanted things like indemnity, they wanted confidentiality, they wanted a guarantee that all liens had been paid, and a lot of times they would attach a release. Sky was the limit. If the plaintiff wanted the offer in cash, if the defendant wanted to make payments over time, whatever you wanted to do. So basically, you remember we started this with four things. Four things is what the statute said. And then that's what the legislature intended. And it kind of turned checkers into Chinese checkers. It made things much more complicated. And as a result, the ability to interpret the offers and the odds that they would be ambiguous increased. So it used to be the Supreme Court said that you could attach a release or you could explain what terms you wanted in your proposal, and it would be something simple. I want a general release that the plaintiff agrees to indemnify the defendant from any other claims arising from this incident. If you put that in the PFS, the Supreme Court would say, no, that's simple, straightforward. We allow that, no problem. But then the defendant would attach, for example, a release that included things that asked for more than what they described in the PFS. And that would be inconsistent. And the problem is that whether you're a defendant evaluating an offer or a plaintiff evaluating the offer, if what is attached is inconsistent with what you see, then it's hard to tell, what are they offering me? And essentially the rule is, if you look at the offer and what's attached and you have to ask a question, then that means it's ambiguous and it's not going to be enforceable. So even if you trigger the money amount, you meet the 25% threshold, you aren't going to be entitled to fees because your proposal was ambiguous, and we don't penalize people for ambiguity. Sometimes the release exceeded the terms. For example, if you make an offer to two plaintiffs, for example, the defendant says, I will offer plaintiff A $100, and then the release says, but you have to, plaintiff B has to dismiss their claim also. That would be unenforceable because the Supreme Court has said you have to allow each plaintiff or each defendant to evaluate the offer separately. So you can't, my ability to accept the offer can't be tied to my co-defendant or my co-plaintiff's desire to settle or not settle. And essentially, if I have a co-party and they don't want, they want to do something different than I do, accept or reject, I shouldn't be forced to do what they want to do. They need to be untethered, essentially. So, like I said, what would happen is the plaintiff would say, no, I don't know what you're talking about. I'm not going to accept the offer. And then litigation would ensue when the case was over. Another one, an example that would creep up is that you make the $100,000 offer. The plaintiff only gets $50,000 at trial, but the offer included a demand for confidentiality. All right, well, the defendant met the 25% threshold. The plaintiff did less than what their offer was, but the defendant didn't get confidentiality. Did they get what they demanded? How do you get 25% of confidentiality? So the First District recently resolved this and said, look, proposals for settlement are meant to resolve monetary disputes. So this proposal, because it included a demand for an apology letter, is not going to be enforceable. The Florida Supreme Court recently, sua sponte, that means they did it on their own, proposed an amendment to the rule that would eliminate non-monetary terms, and effective July 1st, 2022, that became the rule. Now, for a proposal for settlement, the only non-monetary term that you can include is one that requires dismissal with prejudice, or if it's authorized by a particular statute, for example, the eminent domain statute, you can require transfer of title or something like that. The Supreme Court made that decision after it heard, it received written comments and it held oral arguments. A lot of what my practice is no one in my office is allowed to send a proposal for settlement unless I read it first. And I spend a lot of time looking at proposals for settlement for other people who, when the case is over, they're like, I won. Is my proposal enforceable? Or, I did not do well. I'm frightened. Can you get me out of it? And the first place I would look when I was asked to do that is, can I find a way to slip out of it through non-monetary terms? And now that those have been eliminated, I have a feeling that proposals for settlement are going to be a lot easier to enforce. The proposals I'm seeing lately since the rule was enacted have become a lot more simplistic. And simplistic is good. Simplistic is what you want. Because the point of the exercise is that when you're the party who is receiving the offer, like I said, you want to be able to look at it and see that everything looks right. They've complied with the statute. They've complied with the rule. And if you get everything right, then the party who rejects it, they made a bad judgment call. But if they don't get everything right, if they don't dot all the I's and cross all the T's, follow the rule and the statute, mess up on a detail, and the right to fees disappears. So again, I feel like the court is moving in the right direction, the Supreme Court, because it used to be that any minor inconsistency was enough to help you slip out of a PFS if you had not met the monetary threshold. Now, if, for example, and I've seen this lots of times, the person would write a check, essentially. They'd say $25,000 in numbers, but then when they went to write the words, they'd say $20,000. Okay, that's not a minor incongruence. If you are looking at that, you're asking yourself, do they mean 25 or do they mean 20? That's never going to be enforceable. But in the old days, if your proposal for settlement, remember, the rule says that you have to state whether it includes a claim for attorney's fees. And it used to be that if you didn't follow the letter of that, then your proposal wasn't enforceable. And starting in 2016, the Supreme Court said, enough, seriously. The case was called Kajda v. Bordenderry, and they said, look, the rule is intended to implement the statute. And they said the procedural rule should no more be allowed to trump the statute here than the tail should be allowed to wag the dog. Procedural rules should not be strictly construed to defeat a statute it is designed to implement. Since that ruling, trial courts, it's kind of like trying to turn around an aircraft carrier. It's a slow process for the attorneys to get the message and then the attorneys to argue that point to the trial judges and then the cases to get through the appellate courts, the district courts of appeal. But since 2016, we're seeing a lot more instances where the Supreme Court and the appellate courts, the district courts, are saying, look, don't nitpick a PFS looking for a way to make it invalid. If you could understand it at the time that it was made, then it's going to be valid and the penalty is going to be imposed. And that is helping proposals for settlement bloom into actual resolution of cases. That one was a stretch, y'all, I know. I was looking for anything to make it colorful. I will tell you that when yesterday we were going through slides and I eliminated some because the presentation was long and it meant that a couple slides got placed in the wrong spot. I'm not going to give you vertigo and swing through these really fast looking for it, but it's slide 45 in your presentation. I just want to note that there are some things that you cannot use a proposal for settlement to resolve. For example, a declaratory judgment action. If you sue your insurance company because they've said that they're not going to provide coverage and you're suing to get them to provide coverage, a PFS won't cover that. If you're suing for an injunction, you need a former employee to quit competing with you because they signed a non-compete. A PFS isn't going to resolve that. They're meant to resolve, as written, the statute is meant to resolve monetary damages only. All right. Let's say perfect 10, your PFS is simplistic. It's everything it's supposed to be. There's still the hurdle that you have to get around what that judgment obtained is. The plaintiff's judgment obtained has to be 25% more or 25% less. The statute says, it's worded differently depending on whether it's a defendant or a plaintiff. For the purposes of making the determination when a defendant makes an offer to the plaintiff, the term judgment obtained means the amount of the net judgment entered plus any post-offer collateral source payments received or due as of the date of the judgment, plus any post-offer settlement amounts by which the verdict was reduced. And for a plaintiff, when the plaintiff is trying to trigger entitlement to fees, they can only add back in any post-offer settlement amounts by which the verdict was reduced. So if you are not a lawyer and you don't operate in this world, I will give you a quick primer on how judgments work. So let's say a pedestrian's hit in a crosswalk and they are going to sue the person who ran the red light, but they're also going to sue the company that created the timer for that little stick figure that tells you when it's safe to walk because they say the stick figures should have been timed to run later to give red light runners more time. So the plaintiff serves two PFSs, one to the red light runner, one to the timer company. The red light runner accepts, the light designer doesn't. The light designer serves a PFS on the plaintiff. The plaintiff does not accept. Actually, that was wrong. That should be in reverse. Sorry, I didn't see that the 800 times I've read these slides. Point being, one offer is accepted, one offer is not. Case goes to trial, and the jury awards the plaintiff $200,000 for medical bills and pain and suffering. The judge is going to take the amount of the jury's verdict, $200,000, and then reduce it by the settlement amount because you don't get a double recovery for the same incident. And then the judge is going to reduce by collateral sources, which are insurance payments. And I've grossly generalized it here. I'm sure that these guys probably could twitch a little. There's just not enough time to explain all the nuances. Let's say collateral sources are $50,000 here. So now the $200,000, the judgment that the judge enters is going to be $50,000. The jury awarded $200,000, but you have to adjust it for essentially fairness concerns. There's a statute, 57.041, and it says that when you're the prevailing party, you're entitled to your taxable costs. So the judge is going to take that $50,000 adjusted verdict, and then they're going to enter a judgment for costs. Sometimes they do it together. In my experience, they usually do it separately. So let's say the taxable costs here are $8,000. So you've got $58,000. Under the PFS statute, when you're trying to determine whether penalties have been triggered. Remember, we just saw, oh geez, that's ugly. sorry, going back here, that $58,000, you're going to add back in the $100,000 offer, because the idea being at the time that the offer was made, nobody knew that there were other settlements coming. There was no certainty involved. So that money gets added back on. So now you're at $158,000. And if it's the defendant who's trying to trigger the penalty, the defendant couldn't know what the plaintiff's insurance situation was, what the collateral benefits were when they made the offer. So you add back those. The plaintiff, however, would know that. So if the plaintiff is moving, then the plaintiff only gets to add back in the settlement offers that weren't certain yet. You might want to close your eyes. Okay. So the Supreme Court has recently interpreted the judgment obtained to say that now when you're playing with that verdict amount and you're entering your judgments, you have to subtract money. And what the Supreme Court says is you need to go in and you need to figure out what the costs were and the prejudgment interest on those costs on the date that the proposal was served. And then you need to adjust the judgment obtained by subtracting any costs or any prejudgment interest that was earned or required to be paid after the date the offer was made. This is a sample of the math that you have to do from one of my cases. It's intense. And basically, that's a lot more complicated than what the legislature requires. The court decided this issue in a case called CCM v. Petrie Positive. It was a 2021 case. And the court didn't decide it by interpreting the statute. They decided it by relying on precedent. And Justice Kennedy wrote a dissent, and he said, look, guys, if we actually look at the statute and what the statute says, what we're allowing today is not consistent with the simplicity of the statute. So I would suggest that the reality is that when a plaintiff is offering a proposal for settlement, what they're thinking is, all right, if this case goes the distance, I'm going to probably be able to recover X. There's value in the certainty of a resolution. You never know what a jury is going to do. There is value in resolving early. So I'm going to offer Y. And the defendant thinks, all right, if I'm going to go to trial, my exposure is probably X based on where we are in the litigation. Early offers are usually lower. I'm willing to end it now for Y. The plaintiff should give me, it's usually a haircut because I'm offering to end it now for Y. The defendant, and maybe these guys might disagree, but I don't think they're ever trying to think, okay, so I'm guessing that this is the expert that's been retained and this is how much they've paid and the prejudgment interest on that cost is this, so this is how I have to figure out what my offer is. One suggestion is that you could create simplicity by changing a few words in the statute. And I'm not going to drag you through these slides. I will just say that Justice Kennedy said, essentially what our ruling today requires a trial court to do is to create a hypothetical, that was his word, hypothetical judgment, trying to predict what the judgment would have been on the date the proposal was served. We shouldn't be doing that. It should be more simplistic than that because the statute was created to be simplistic. And again, I would just propose that clarity would help there. Another issue is the difference, that 25% that we talked about. I have heard a suggestion that it could be lowered, and the most recent figure I heard was 10%. And this is my declaratory judgments, no-fly zone, wound up in the wrong place, sorry. The pros. I think that there are pros to lowering it to 10%. If it's you're not talking about an insurance company defendant, which is, I think, its own special ball of wax, the argument in favor of lowering it is that I think defendants are probably going to make better offers and plaintiffs are going to make more offers. So if a defendant makes a lowball offer that the plaintiff only has to beat by 10%, the plaintiffs aren't going to take them. They know that they can beat it, and the defendant is never going to trigger the penalty of fees. The way that you get cases to resolve is when you find that sweet spot in your offer so that when your opponent gets it, their cheeks pucker and they think, I could expose my client to danger here if I don't take this offer. My client and I really need to have a conversation about whether we want to go ahead and accept. Meanwhile, the plaintiffs are more incentivized to serve a proposal for settlement. And a lot of times, a proposal for settlement isn't, as written, it's not accepted. It starts a conversation. And for plaintiffs, they often hesitate to send offers in the first place because they feel like they're creating their own cap. It's going to be a ceiling in negotiations. For example, when they get to mediation, the defendant is going to say, look, you sent me a proposal for settlement for $100. That's where you were willing to settle. So we're going to be negotiating down from there. So if a plaintiff is going to have to send an offer that's 25% less than what they think they could get at trial, they're going to be less inclined to send them. However, if now you're talking about offering 10% less than what they expect they could get at trial, okay, well, that's a lot more palatable, and that's a ceiling that they could be a lot more willing to create. As for cons, the statute is a penalty. It is a punishment. It is a sanction. Those three words are the ones that are used in the case law consistently. The party that rejects the offer, they misevaluated either its value or they misevaluated the things that either a judge in a bench trial or a jury in a jury trial might attach to. And in tort cases particularly, deciding what amount to put on a PFS is as much an art as it is a science. And that is true for the plaintiff and the defense, because genuinely, when you are trying to predict what a jury of six people will do, I sometimes feel like consulting a Ouija board is going to give you the same level of accuracy. It's hard. And 25% is forgiving if you misevaluate. 10% is not as much. So my task was to try to explain the statute to you at a high level and try to point out a few areas that could be resolved. I think there are other more granular areas that could be resolved. I didn't want to throw those at you in this first session, lest everybody have a headache. I think what I've given you already is a lot to take in. So thank you for having me, and I look forward to any questions you might have.
Thank you, Ms. Luke. I don't know if I've ever seen such a complete presentation filled with so many interesting pictures, and we couldn't hear the sound, but videos, and yeah, there were a lot of numbers there. A lot of numbers for this, probably the most we've seen in this subcommittee, but a very, very thorough presentation. Felt like I was back in law school a little bit there.
Well, so thank you. It's not exactly the sexiest material you're going to see all sessions, so I wanted to try to make it interesting.
Thank you.
Jordan, can I close this?
I will now open the floor to panelists for a discussion, and I would just say a couple minutes and really open up to what you want to talk about, obviously this topic, and maybe introduce yourself, and then after a couple minutes each, we'll open the entire subcommittee up for questions for any one of the four. Is that great? Let's start with Mr. Gillum. Welcome, sir, or we can start with Mr. Alexander, whichever one of you two wants to go first, and then we'll just go down the row. Flip a coin. You're recognized.
Thank you, Chairman. My name is Braxton Gillum. I'm a Jacksonville lawyer. I see some of our representatives here on the committee. I'm happy to be here today. My practice is a little different from the initial speaker. I have a business practice. My firm represents businesses in both lawsuits. And we end up being on the plaintiff side and defense side sometimes because it's business-to-business disputes most of the time. And I would say to you, and I won't take too long, but the impact of this statute on our claims is maybe different than as articulated a few minutes ago. I'll give you an example. From a business-to-business dispute situation, the numbers are more fixed many times. If you have a contract dispute, it may be over a missed payment or a non-payment. So you know exactly what kind of money you're talking about as opposed to soft cost issues with your personal injury claims. And so I'll kind of start with where the last speaker finished. When you start talking about a threshold to evaluate, that is an interesting topic, I think, for your committee to consider if you're looking at changes to the statute. Because if it's a $50,000 debt, for instance, and you
sir,
have to...
Real quick, is your mic on, or are you not speaking closely enough to the mic? Just want to make sure.
It's on, but maybe I was not close
That's
enough.
That's great. Thank you.
Sorry. I was making an example of the distinction between a hard cost type case as opposed to a soft cost case. In a business context, we generally know when we're filing a claim or defending a claim, it's over a specific issue, a specific, for instance, invoice or a charge or a contract agreed sum. And so when you start talking about a factor of, for instance, 25% for a discount, I mean, that has more impact and it's more measurable than I think the type of claims that the prior speaker was talking about. This also relates to, you know, first-party insurance claims, and I won't spend much time on this either, but I know that significant changes occurred this year, particularly with the repeal of 627-428 fees for insurance-type claims. Those things impact our businesses, too. And if you've got to bring a claim on behalf of a business who's already being sued, for instance, being able to evaluate and create risk for another business or an insurance company who's refusing to provide coverage or refusing to pay a claim becomes very important. And I would say to you that it is extremely complex. You know that now from the presentation you just saw. It's not as simple as we'd like it to be. Anything you can do in this process to make it simpler, more certain, is appreciated for practitioners. I tell clients all the time, you bring us a case, you bring us the facts, we try hard to fit those facts into a story and apply the law to those facts when we make presentations to the court. We don't make facts. That's not true when it comes to proposal for settlement. When lawyers are developing proposals for settlement, they're making the facts for their clients. So we're particularly concerned about it being a simple, manageable, and predictable process. And so it is important, and again, I've got suggestions as well, and I think you know my other peers do as well to talk to you about it, if you have questions about those. But I appreciate the opportunity to be here and speak to you today. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Geisenheimer, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is James Geisenheimer. I am with the Berger Singerman Law Firm in Miami, Florida. And like Mr. Gillum, I practice business in the area of business law, representing companies in disputes in court, the type of cases that were referenced, non-compete type cases and the like. So my practice overlaps substantially with Mr. Gillum's, and we see a lot of the same problems and the issues with regards to the proposal for settlement rules are different than I think you see in the personal injury type arena. And the complications are also different. And perhaps if I can sort of give you two anecdotal cases where these disputes are highlighted and help maybe drive some of the suggestions. And it also might help provide some clarity on some of the issues that were discussed at a very high level. For example, one of the areas that often is problematic is the area of vicarious liability. So for example, you have a doctor who works at a surgery center, and you have a surgery center, and the doctor is sued for malpractice, and the surgery center is in the position of being held vicariously liable for the doctor. This was an issue in the Hess case out of the Second District. And the way the statute's currently drafted allowed the lawyers involved in the case to create a situation where they could both make an offer and get their attorney's fees. So it ended up prolonging the litigation, not shortening the litigation. So what do I mean by that? So in that case, the plaintiff made an offer to the doctor to settle a proposal for settlement for $100,000, and at the same time made an offer to the surgery center to settle for $15,000. And the doctor rejected the offer and went to trial, and the surgery center, who was going to be vicariously liable for the doctor anyway, was not incented to take the offer because it didn't get them out of the case completely. The case goes to trial, and the jury returns a verdict of $23,000. And so the doctor's offer, the offer made to the doctor is not implicated, but the offer made to the business is implicated because it was beaten. And the judge then enters an award of $99,000 of attorney's fees, which the surgery center had to pay. Now, the surgery center is not directly liable, only because of the doctrine of vicarious liability, meaning that they have to answer for their doctors. Were they involved in this lawsuit? And because the rules and the case law allows them to make separate offers, that was the problem. The interesting anecdote about that story is the doctor and the surgery center, early on in the case, made an offer to settle the case for $25,000. Which was within 6% of the final result. So the common law rule without the statute would have resulted in a better result, and a more economic resolution from the judicial system than the current statute. And the same problem occurs in multi-party cases. When you have one plaintiff suing one defendant sure, that's a lot simpler. But when you have multiple plaintiffs and multiple defendants, you get the same problems with offers, the gamesmanship, maybe too harsh a word, but where you're trying to get a settlement early on in the case with one party and then still have the ability to get attorney's fees later on in the case. So I think there are a lot of areas for improvement that we I thank you for the opportunity to hear your questions and hopefully help clarify them. But thank you again for your time.
Great. Thank you. Mr. Alexander, you're recognized.
My name is Kurt Alexander, and as it has been alluded to repeatedly, I defend personal injury cases primarily. I don't sue people. I defend suits. I defend suits on behalf of companies. I defend suits on behalf of people. They could be insurance companies. They could be other kinds of companies. But I'm defending personal injury suits. Now, you see what has happened to this statute. It started as a great idea. Encourage people to settle cases early, save expense, save trauma, save trouble, get the cases done early. What has happened, and it won't surprise you when lawyers and judges have gotten a hold of it, is there are complications that have had to be addressed, and so it's gotten very complicated. You saw just in the example of costs, what happens with the calculation of costs. Well, costs could be taken out of the calculation completely, and then we don't have to mess with any of that. Just use the number of the judgment without figuring in costs, before and after. End of discussion. The other thing that has happened to this, it does encourage settlements, but it is a tool against defendants, not against plaintiffs, though it says that it is. Now, that's not a universal thing that happens every time, but in the vast majority of cases, this is leverage against a defendant who has the money to pay for the attorney's fees that could be awarded. Now, yes, the statute does provide that a plaintiff could be held liable for the attorney's fees of the defense. But in the vast majority of cases, these plaintiffs don't have the money to be able to pay the costs and attorney's fees of the defense, and so it's illusory. The statute is a way of encouraging settlements by pressuring defendants, by increasing the risk to defendants. If that's what you want to do, that's what it does. If it's not what you want to do, and the statute seems to try to have an even-handed approach to it, encouraging both sides to settle, it is not what it's doing. It is also, in the personal injury arena, very subject to abuse. Because what happens is, when it is subject to abuse, and it is not uncommon, and again, I'm defending cases, so a plaintiff's counsel will file a proposal for settlement. They'll file it for an amount of money that's within someone's insurance coverage, because that's a very common thing with what I deal with. However, it's going to be early in the suit. So the timing in the statute is very early. I would encourage you to increase the timing in the statute. The proposal for settlement can be filed 30 days after the complaint is served. Well, sorry, 90 days after the complaint is served. Well, there's a discovery phase. The defense is always playing catch up. So if I'm defending a case, I have to figure out what's going on. I have to get their information. If they don't give it to me, I don't have it, the client doesn't have it, and it becomes impossible to evaluate that case. If that goes on for the mere 30 days that that proposal for settlement offer of judgment is open, it's open for 30 days and then it's closed. If that goes on for that 30 days, it's closed. They've locked in a demand that is within the insurance limits, but it wasn't able to be evaluated, so it wasn't paid. I have seen many defendants try to pay that demand later and have it be rejected. And now attorney's fees, now you find out that there was a surgery. Now you find out that there were large medical bills that are in excess of the coverage. Now you're locked in with this proposal for settlement that virtually guarantees the plaintiff's attorney fees and costs from the time that it was offered forward. Now we're stuck in a case with a tail definitely wagging the dog, because even though the same amount of money that was demanded is offered, it won't be accepted now. It's a much larger demand, and attorney's fees may be driving the case rather than the actual interests of the insured person. Now, I'm not saying that it's a bad idea to encourage early settlements. I think it's a wonderful idea. I think the statute had wonderful intentions. I think that the way the statute has been implemented and the details that we have seen now over many years come together, it has become, in the area in which I deal, rife with abuse. And there are fixes to this. There are things that could make it better. Some have proposed that the statute just be repealed completely, that it's not serving its purpose and it's not fixable. I think it probably is improvable. It's fixable in many respects. I actually have come up with a draft statute with changes I can provide the chair if the chair wishes, but there are many things that can be changed to help fix it. Time periods can be expanded, costs can be taken out. If people weren't able to give the proposal for settlement so soon in the case, then more of the discovery would be worked out. It wouldn't have the risk of surprise. That could be expanded. If the proposal was offered and left open by statute for more than 30 days, it could help give time to evaluate the offer. If the real reason for the statute and real reason for the offers is to promote an early settlement, then it makes sense to give the parties simply time to evaluate the offers and meet them if they are sincere. So, you can tell I am used to soapboxes, and I appreciate your time. I don't want to take more than is allotted to me. I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. I'd love to see that draft, and we're used to soapboxes up here as well. Members, any questions for our distinguished panel? It is your turn. Representative Koster, you're recognized. And if you want to direct your question to a specific panelist or open it up, it's totally up to you, Representative.
Thank you. I think my first question is for you, Mr. Alexander. First of all, thank you all for being here and for all of the information. It's super complex, and you boiled it down, I know, as best you could, so thank you. You said the PFS gets filed. When you say filed, it's not actually getting filed with the court, right? Like the judge and jury or prospective jury, nobody sees it until the case is over, correct?
Mr. Alexander, you're recognized.
Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am, that is correct. There is a notice of filing a proposal for settlement, so the court knows it's been filed, but the actual proposal, the actual offer, is not made known to anyone except for the other party and their attorney. You're absolutely correct.
Representative Koster, you're right.
A follow-up to that. If there are co-defendants or co-plaintiffs, do they become privy to the terms of the proposal for settlement if it's only directed to one party?
Ms. Alexander, you're recognized.
Yes, sir. They do not officially, and they are not required to be notified. They are often made aware of it by the parties, unless they're trying to keep it secret for some other reason. But it is common to let other parties know what is going on with that.
Representative Koster, you recognize.
Thank you. It's not confidential. Like, I know normally settlement discussions would be confidential, sort of. So these are not necessarily confidential from other co-parties.
Mr. Alexander, you're recognized.
Yes, sir. They are confidential by nature, but that confidentiality depends on the parameters adhered to by the people involved in it. So it doesn't have to remain confidential in the context of a proposal for settlement. Though the judges, we are not supposed to allow the judges to know exactly what's going on in terms of the offers and demands.
Are you good, Representative Koster?
A different question, but if you want to go to somebody
sure.
else first.
Let me go to Representative Chamberlain. You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This will be a couple of questions here. But is there anything requiring, and I'm just curious, Mr. Alexander, is there anything requiring in your expense or anyone in your experience, help me with, I'm not an attorney, I'm not involved every day, I've been on the defendant side, been on that side, but is there anything requiring expenses to be disclosed before settlement?
Mr. Alexander, you're recognized.
Yes, sir. That answer is no, and that is a major problem and one of a change that I would propose. The fact of including costs of an opposing side when those costs are not known and there is no obligation to disclose them makes it guesswork. There is a certain degree of guesswork that could be excluded from that by excluding costs. As Ms. Lucas said, the proposals for settlement are as much art as they are science, that's a nice way of saying there's a lot of guesswork involved, and I think it would be well served to take out the guesswork.
And I'll hop in real quick. Is there anyone on the panel that disagrees with that, removing costs from the... Ms. Luca, you're recognized.
Sorry. There's Florida Supreme Court precedent that establishes that a prejudgment interest is a form of damages. So you're going to include prejudgment interest. And for a lot of cases, and I'd be interested as to what Mr. Gassenheimer and... I remember your really awesome first name, but I don't remember your last name. Gillum. What Mr. Gillum think, because they handle contract disputes. So in contract disputes, your costs, you're entitled to recover prejudgment interest on your costs because that's considered a form of your damages, because the idea being when you brought the lawsuit against the person who breached the contract, they required you to hire a lawyer and to pay those lawyers and to... spend the money associated with the lawsuit. So that's why it's all lumped together as part of your damages. So I agree with Mr. Alexander, and I think all three panelists, I think we could probably agree that it's in a personal injury action or a products liability case, because you're talking about someone being injured, that those are a different breed of animal than a commercial dispute. I would disagree about excluding costs, though, because the reason that we have a prevailing party statute for costs, which is 57.041, is a recognition that when somebody aggrieves you in a way that a jury or a judge finds they should not have, then they required you to spend money in order to be able to obtain that result. And I think that it would be contradictory to the policy behind allowing prevailing party costs to say that for the purposes of a PFS statute, we're going to pretend that you didn't recover those costs.
President Chamberlain, you have a follow-up?
Yes, thank you,
Chair.
I don't know if there's a percentage that floats out there, but how common is it for a defendant to feel like they were blindsided by absorbent costs that were never discussed with them, and they just have no idea? So their $100,000 settlement now results in them thinking they were getting close to that $100,000. They're getting 10% of that $100,000. Everything else is going to cost that they had no idea. Is that a common thing that's going on in today's world? Because I guess my thought would be, when the statute was written, that probably wasn't in the thought process that that would be happening when that was written. So...
Well, so there's...
Ms. Lou, you're recognized.
Oh, sorry. At the end of the Florida Rules of Civil Procedure, there is a guide to taxable costs, and it puts a limit, a lot of limits, actually, on what a plaintiff can recover or a defendant can recover as taxable costs. Basically, it's broken into three categories: things that must be taxed, for example, your filing fee, the cost of your depositions, things that should be taxed, which is a place where the court has discretion, and things that cannot be taxed. You know, the cost of Xeroxing, the cost of there's a research engine, there's Westlaw and there's Lexis. You can't charge those. Those are overhead fees, basically. So I was speaking generally about costs, but it's always taxable costs, which are things that the judge has discretion to say, you hired a court reporter that charges $300 an hour? That's ridiculous. Court reporters charge $100 an hour. I'm not allowing that cost. It happens with some frequency, and it's meant to tamp down on what the costs were. And Chair Robinson, I don't know what the procedure is. I don't want to depart from Ms. Representative Chamberlain's question. I did have a comment that I think would be helpful about something Mr. Alexander said that's informative.
Sure, proceeding. I know Mr. Gillum has something he wants to say, so.
Well, if we want to stay on topic for that, if you want to come back to me at the end.
Yeah, let's stay on topic on this issue. Mr. Gillum, did you have something you would like to say on the cost situation?
Real quick, two issues. One, interest and costs are distinct. So I don't think this is an interest issue, it's a cost issue. And I would say about the cost, in my mind, removing cost from the calculation would avoid confusion. I mean, the point of the process, again, is to allow certainty or more certainty. And so here's the problem with having costs in the calculation. You've got a case, and it's, I'm going to make numbers up, it's a $10,000 case, and someone makes a $7,500 offer, 75% of that $10,000 case, trying to qualify under the statute for the 25%. Well, they miss it by $100. Well, that means I get my attorney's fees. No, if you include costs, then someone puts up a cost bill that wasn't really part of the discovery in the case. Maybe there's a medical bill for $30,000 that will be, or an inspection or not an inspection. Someone has an IME, an IME is when, under the statute, you've got a right as a defendant to have a doctor look at the patient and see their injury. And you have to pay for that. That would be a cost that might be recoverable. Well, if you can add that to the damage number in the calculation, that's what's hidden is what Mr. Alexander is referring to. If you just talk about the actual damages and forget about the cost, it gives more certainty to the parties when they're making the offer that that's a reasonable offer. Again, I would go back to, I think that, you know, this whole fact, the 25% factor is arbitrary to begin with. I mean, we're trying to create a process to encourage people to settle because of risk. And I kind of disagree with Mr. Alexander on this. I think we should continue to have a process to encourage folks to settle cases because of risk going forward of owing fees. I think adding risk to the system to encourage settlement is good. It's good for the judicial system. It's good for parties. But again, it's this cost issue. I agree it creates confusion, and that's not helpful to anybody, I don't think. That's where you can game the system. Thank you.
Ms. Legal, would you like to
say
something? You're recognized.
I could address that point that Mr. Gillum made. It's that when the offer was made and the other side evaluated it and they chose to reject it, now the case has to continue. So that inspection that your expert has to conduct and you have to pay for, the reason that you have to pay your expert to conduct that inspection is because your offer to settle the case was rejected. So in that instance, I think that, again, it flies against the policy of giving prevailing party costs if you're going to say we're only going to look at the damages, because a huge reason why people settle cases is because they want certainty. They don't want the uncertainty of having to go to trial, and they want to end it, because as long as the litigation continues, you are paying to continue it. You are paying your experts. You are paying the court reporters who are sitting there transcribing the depositions. You are incurring all of these costs. And the only reason you're incurring them is because someone rejected your offer. So I would argue that it is not as black and white as here's my proposal for settlement and here's all of my costs. And here is what I expect the prejudgment interest is going to be. So there is all of the information. Now you evaluate it. Mr. Alexander is right. That's not currently the way that the system works. And I'm not sure exactly how workable that would be. Because quite honestly, if you're going to require a plaintiff or a defendant to, at the same time that they serve their offer, figure out what all of their taxable costs are, I promise you, you're going to see a lot less offers. That is I don't remember if you remember that slide I showed you. That is a pain in the neck of the highest order. A lot of times, parties resolve costs by settling because they don't want to go through that sort of minutia. And don't forget, there are times where people have to go to the court to argue about their costs, because the defense might say, okay, you can have a court reporter, but not at $300 an hour. So even costs aren't entirely certain. There is, like I said, there is a little bit of art to this, but I would definitely argue that eliminating costs altogether, while yes, it could create certainty, it would be unfair because... And it would also, if you had to produce all of your costs at the time you made the offer, I think it would discourage people from making offers in the first place.
I think I've morphed from chairman to judge. This is definitely an interesting. I want to circle, because I have a lot of members that have questions. So I want to circle back. Representative Chairman, are you done? Do you have any more questions?
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
We may circle back to this issue, but I have several members that have some questions, and it may dive into some other issues that we may want to get into. Representative Joseph, You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple questions for varying members of the panel. Starting with Ms. Luca, you had talked about the pros and cons of lowering the percentage to 10% as opposed to 25%, but then you alluded to an exception when dealing with perhaps personal injury cases, but I'm not sure. You just said insurance cases. I got an impression it was a defense side issue, but I wasn't sure what the issue was. Can you elaborate on that?
Ms. Luca, you're recognized.
So I do have a little bit of a concern about what it means for plaintiffs who are involved in litigation with small claims that involve insurance companies. And I think anecdotes are very useful. One of my friends, she's a single mother. She has two children, and a tree fell on her house, and it damaged her roof. She made a claim under her homeowner's policy. They denied it. It's $10,000 to fix her roof. If she has to make an offer for 25% less than that, then that means she can't afford to fix her roof. If she has to make an offer for 10% less, that helps, but it still leaves her in a position where she's got to make up the difference. And now, if the insurance company makes an offer for 10% less and she accepts it, her lawyer has no way to be paid, which means my concern is more an access to courts concern. If you lower it that way and you get more plaintiffs who are accepting offers on small cases like that, I'm concerned that lawyers are going to stop taking those kinds of cases altogether, and you're going to create an access to courts issue. And I'm not sure exactly how you fix that. I was tasked with flagging issues, and so I'm flagging it as an issue for this subcommittee to consider as you're looking at other factors. And I think it's something that would require a much more in-depth discussion.
Representative Joseph, you're recognized.
Thank you. So following up on that, I guess if we were trying to ascertain, and this leads me into the question that I had for, I guess, Mr. Gillum, you had alluded to some distinctions that are required or should be considered as it relates to first property insurance claims and the differences between those and personal injury claims and some of the ones that you deal with, dealing with hard costs that are a little bit more, solid, like contract disputes. When we're looking at different kinds of claims, in the past, the legislature had treated personal injury claims one way and first property kinds of claims a different way. With some recent legislation that was passed, some of that has been eliminated, creating the access to courts issue that you just identified. If we as a body was trying to be more equitable in favor of the consumer and or the property owner, whomever, but also recognizing the difference between the personal injury claims and the ones that you alluded to, how would you, if you all were waving your magic wand and coming up with a solution, how would you delineate that distinction and how it should be addressed?
Ms. Gillum, you're recognized.
Through the chair, thank you. This does get to the issue I was alluding to earlier. If you're talking about insurance, if I've got a business client who's got $100,000 in coverage, with the deletion of 627-428, the only thing my client can do to create leverage to try to get a resolution for an insurance company that says no to them on coverage is to offer to settle for $74,999 to get underneath the threshold. So basically, instead of having $100,000 in coverage, we got $75,000 in coverage. And that's a real problem for mom-and-pop small businesses in Florida and some of my clients. And so I do think this is a very important statute, and the work you're doing to try to, again, bring more certainty to it, I think is important. But my business clients are not opposed to looking at this metric and trying to maybe make that metric smaller because, again, our numbers are real numbers. I don't mean the personal injury claims are real numbers too. My business client, so we're talking about hard numbers, identifiable numbers from day one. They buy $100,000 of coverage. They were expecting $100,000 in coverage. I have a contract right. I agree to do something for $50,000. I expected to get $50,000. And having no ability, access to courts issue, if it's a $50,000 claim, I can't bring that claim for my client, try to recover that unpaid sum for $50,000 if the other party forces me to go to trial. So, yeah, you are impacting access to courts. And with the only thing they're left with is a proposal for settlement where they've got to take a 25% haircut. That's material to small mom-and-pop businesses. So I would tell you that it is important, in my opinion. Thank you.
President Joseph, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Questions for Mr. Gillum again. And the gentleman from Berger Singerman, I forgot your name. You both alluded to you have some suggestions. I know your colleague said he has a draft that he's willing to prepare or provide. I think Ms. Luca alluded to some suggestions as well. If you were giving the committee your suggestions, what would they be specifically?
Maybe Mr. Gassenheimer, we haven't heard from you in a while. Why don't you take that one?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, James Gassenheimer from Berger Singerman. So, for example, to expand a little bit on what Mr. Gillum said about the statute he was referring to that was eliminated was the statute that in insurance cases you can no longer recover attorney's fees against when you're suing an insurance company to get coverage. And that creates the problem that Ms. Luca alluded to for her friend who had the roof for $10,000, the business. You know, if I own a business and I have warehouse insurance and I have $100,000 worth of widgets in my warehouse that get destroyed and the insurance company won't pay for them, I'm out. There's no way for me to recover. So some of the things. So I talked about the vicarious liability issue. So if you have in that case, the doctor who's primarily responsible and the orthopedic surgery center that's vicariously responsible, or the truck driver who was negligent and then the owner of the truck. Currently under the system, those are treated as two separate parties and a plaintiff can make an offer to just one and not the other. When your responsibility is only because of what the law calls vicarious liability or just some affiliation and you didn't directly do anything wrong, I think the statute needs to make it clear that that should be treated as one party and that there's one resolution. If I'm willing to take $100,000 to settle that case, I shouldn't be able to game the system by making an offer to one party for $100,000, as happened in the Hess case, and $15,000 to the surgery center to set up that fee claim, because that encourages the litigation to go on. It doesn't do what the statute was intended, which was to end it. I think you know, to add on to something that Representative Chamberlain alluded to and my colleagues were talking about, the issue that most parties struggle with when they receive one of these offers is transparency and disclosure. The system is only fair if I can make an informed decision. One of the things that is the Supreme Court's talking about is, you know, adding to our Florida system what we have in the federal court system, which is very early on in the case, the party who brings the case is required to make mandatory disclosures. If you were to build into the statute some provision that if I'm going to make an offer, I have to have, in good faith, given the party who's going to consider that offer all the information necessary to evaluate the offer, then I'm making an informed decision. I think that goes to the cost issue. Again, I don't think anybody's arguing that costs shouldn't be recovered as part of the offer judgment. But in that circumstance where I get the offer and I'm trying to calculate whether I'm likely to be hit with attorney's fees, if I don't know about a $50,000 engineering bill because you hired an engineer to do some work, when I'm trying to evaluate the offer that's going to get tacked on to the judgment to determine whether I beat the offer, that's unfair to me in evaluating. So I would strongly encourage to find some way to require some type of good faith disclosures of all the information necessary for the party receiving the offer. I think you'll see more offers accepted under those circumstances, because I'm making an informed decision. So hopefully that was helpful.
Thank you. Can I make sure I understood? I have three points from you. One is restore. Is that okay, Mr. Chair?
It is. I just want to get to other members. Do you have a quick question?
Yep, I'm going to make sure I got it. Restore the recovery of attorney's fees for first property or other cases where they have hard costs as opposed to personal injury cases is what I'm hearing. Two was to make, when you have multiple parties, if the offer for settlement is inextricably linked, so you can't have one without the other, you want to keep that as one proposal for settlement. And the third is making mandatory disclosures akin to what we have in the federal system. That basically
Mr. Chair?
Sure, you're recognized.
Yes, you've accurately described my suggestions.
Thank you. Great, thank you. Ms. Luger, did you have anything to respond on Representative Joseph's question and ideas moving forward?
What I heard was slightly different, and Mr. Gassenheimer, correct me if I heard incorrectly. So there's a difference between initial disclosures, and this is actually what I wanted to bring up in response to something that Mr. Alexander raised. So in federal court, when you file a lawsuit, within a certain number of days of filing the lawsuit, you have to provide all of the information that's available to you about the case. You know, who the witnesses might be, any documents you might be using, a summary of what your damages are. That, I think, is different than what Mr. Gassenheimer is proposing. What I'm hearing is that you would like for people to, at the time that they make an offer, provide information about what they think their taxable costs are at the time they make the offer.
Mr. Gassenheimer, you're recognized to explain.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we're overlapping in what we're describing. Yes, I believe that some type of mandatory disclosures of, if you look at the federal form, it actually works very well. Who your witnesses are, so I can go evaluate information. What document, you have to give me your documents, not just tell me about them, right at the beginning of the case, any documents you have. And you have to tell me what your damages are going to be in the case. And so, and if you've incurred costs, then I think you should be required to disclose the amount of those costs. I get that there may be some issues that you may not want to tell me who your experts are at that time, but that doesn't mean you can't tell me how much money you've spent on experts up to that date. So I have all the information I need to make an informed decision.
Representative Beltran, you're recognized.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairman, and thank you to the panelists for your presentation and for your views on the PFS statute. I want to start. I guess my first question is sometimes you see these $500 PFSs, right? So you have a case. It's not a statutory claim. It's not a contractual claim. Presumably, the PFS doesn't play a role there because you're already getting prevailing party attorney fees. You have a negligence claim or something that's not covered by a prevailing party attorney fee. You get a $500 PFS. You get a defense verdict, and then you can get six, or I think one of the panelists was talking about seven-figure exposure for attorney fees. I guess my question for the panel is it fair to take it from each party pays their own fees to a one-way, essentially in favor of a defendant, a one-way prevailing party attorney fee just by putting $500 or $1,000 in the game, and then you can get really infinite attorney fees, or should there be some proportionality between the offer, and I know Section 8A says, you know, it says that the court can determine it's not made in good faith, but should there be some sort of proportionality between the amount of the offer, what you're putting on the table, and what kind of fees you can recover if you trigger that PFS?
Ms. Gill, you're recognized. You seem to want that one. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I'll give you an example. From a construction site, a trespasser used a porta potty and it turned over, and they had a claim based upon being in a porta potty that turned over, and they were trespassing in the first instance, and there's a number of other issues related to that. And so the party that, in this case, the contractor, believes it's a no liability case. How much should they have to offer to expose the plaintiff to attorney's fees in that context? I mean, so the point of a $500 offer, a $1,000 offer, maybe even a $5,000 offer in some instances is simply that it's a no liability case, and you're pursuing a claim against me, and I want to encourage you to stop because you're bringing a frivolous claim. That's the point of those kind of offers, and I will say to you that they may not be appropriate in every case, but they are some cases where they're appropriate.
Representative Beltran, you're recognized.
Yeah, I guess, so I guess my follow-up to that is you have a statutory vehicle. I think you know what it is. You have 57-105. If you believe it's a zero liability case, I mean, then. But should it be the case that every time you get a defense verdict, whether it falls within 57-105 or otherwise, that you can set somebody up for an unlimited amount of fees? Because that's what you would use, right? If it really is a frivolous case, you'd use 57-105, not 768, right?
So you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So a 57.105 claim is a claim akin to a federal court Rule 11 claim where you're saying the claim that's brought is frivolous. There's absolutely no basis in law or fact. I will tell you that the opportunities where that rule or statute is applied and the courts will actually award fees is the smallest number I can think of. And so the example I gave you, the trespasser who uses the porta potty, who falls over and complains about an injury, I will tell you, I don't think that's a frivolous claim. They're going to say they had a claim, they should have been warned. That kind of claim will get to a jury. It will. And I don't think because every case gets to a jury because there's a factual dispute about whether or not there was a duty owed or whether something was inappropriate occurred should mean that there's no fee, a potential for fee recovery by a party who's been sued. That's just my experience.
Representative Belton, you're
recognized. I think the gentleman had
it. Oh, Mr. Alexander, something you wanted to say? You're recognized.
Okay.
I was going to chime in possibly unnecessarily, but
you like that hair. You're recognized.
Yes, sir. I just wanted to chime in and say that the state of the law has changed in Florida a little bit. What we're alluding to or involving is a thing called motions for summary judgment. And it used to be very, very difficult to get a motion for summary judgment, which is getting the court to say there's no question of fact here that a jury should have a look at. We'll just throw this case out. There's nothing here, and we'll throw it out. It's gotten, Florida's gone to match the federal standard, actually, so it's a little easier. It's not as difficult to get them thrown out, but there is a difference between this is so frivolous that we're going to use 57-105 and the attorney themselves could be actually liable for some fees, and just a case of they have a very weak case. I mean, the porta potty, they can argue, it should have been anchored. They may find some OSHA regulation, who knows. But there's a difference between a weak case and the 57-105, which is generally, even in the personal injury arena, an extreme example of this has no basis.
Representative Milton, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chairman. I guess let me just back up a second and talk more broadly. What about just going to the pure English rule, right, that the loser pays? Right, then we don't have to mess around with the PFS statute at all. We have that probably in the majority of cases. Almost every commercial case, if you have a good contract, you have prevailing party attorney fees. Almost any sort of statutory claim, you're going to have a prevailing party attorney fee, employment, consumer protection. We used to have it in insurance. We got rid of it. But I was in the minority on that. I don't think we should have. But and then with the PFSs, you have the PFSs in a lot of tort cases. So we probably have prevailing party at play in the majority of civil litigation. Why not just go to an English model? What does the panel think about that? And then use the PFS statute to evaluate if you made an offer of, you know, and it was a reasonable offer, the other side unreasonably rejected that, then that goes into some of the Rao factors, or at least it goes into these statutory factors we have at 768-79, and we say, well, that goes to the reasonableness of the attorney fee, and that can be subjectively taken into account when you do the lodestar, you enhance or reduce the lodestar. What about that idea?
Mr. Alexander, you're recognized.
Yes, sir. That, in some sense, is almost not my business because that is a fundamental shift in the way that the state of Florida would be approaching lawsuits. Dealing with the proposal for settlement rule and the offer of judgment statute is flirting with that. It's getting closer. It's not just if you lose, you pay, but if you lose by enough, you pay. So I completely understand the question. I understand even, and it's actually very astute to bring it up with this because this is an approximation of that. But switching the state to just loser pays all the time, again, would still be a burden only on the defense for the vast majority of personal injury cases anyway. Business cases might be different. That would have a lot of implications that I'm honestly not fully prepared to address, though the proposal for settlement statute does move us closer to that in many ways.
Ms. Luca, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. I would worry again about access to courts, only ironically, it would be for people who actually have money. Would they be frightened? Because the legal system is, for a lot of people, it's terrifying. And it's a big deal to bring a lawsuit. And I worry about, I know that there, in personal injury lawsuits, people get a bad rap. But for example, in products liability lawsuits, the reason that your safety, that your seatbelt engages in a certain way is because of products liability lawsuits. The reason that a lot of things that you deal with on a daily basis are safer is because of personal liability or because of products liability lawsuits. But those plaintiffs are normal people. They're people like me. And I have a small amount of savings that my kids' college tuition is probably going to eat. But if it happened to me now, gosh, that would make me really, it would put me in a position where I would have to evaluate whether I could afford to file a lawsuit. And I worry about the abuses that are inherent in a system like that.
Mr. Gassheimer, do you have something you want to say? Can you limit to about 30 seconds to 45 seconds?
Yes.
Got several members who want to ask more questions.
Yes, real quick, just again, I would say similar access to courts issues for businesses. Same thing, a small mom and pop business who is confronted with, you know, having to pay attorney's fees in every case, I think that you would be denying them access to courts. And so I would suggest that the English rule is not the right approach.
Representative Oberdorf, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple questions for business law. First of all, when you're looking at confidentiality in a settlement, why would you ever accept a PFS now if you can't have that confidentiality?
Who would like, Mr. Gillen? Would you like that one? You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, you know, we don't have that right if you go to trial either. I mean, the point of the PFS is to discourage more litigation and the time for the courts to deal with litigation. And if you litigate the case through trial and you win or lose, you don't get a confidentiality order. And so I agree with Mr. Alexander. Trying to insert that into the process is confusing. And if you do it in a proposal, you're asking for something in the proposal, you can't get it at the end of the day. I mean, people can settle cases on whatever terms they want to, but trying to impose a sanction for refusal to accept a settlement needs to be more akin to what you could get at the end of the day.
Representative Oberdorf, you're recognized.
So a follow-up to that, and based on your timing in court, typically what is time to trial now, and have you seen a reduction in the time of trial associated with PFS? Is the system actually working as it was designed to do?
Anyone want that one? Mr. Gassenheimer, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So with respect to time to trial, there are many factors that have, and certainly COVID has been a significant driver of the problem. So I don't think you can look at the time to trial as whether the PFS statute, which has been around since 1986, has helped the time to trial. Also, you'd have to look at what was the impact of mandatory mediation and the high number of cases that settled at mediation. That's probably had a stronger effect of shortening the time to trial than the proposal for settlement statute. I would suggest, for the reasons that I tried to articulate, that the proposal for settlement statute has had unintended consequences that it, in fact, discouraged settlement, not encouraged settlement. So I don't think it's been helpful in that regard.
Good.
One last question.
Ms. Luca, did you have something quick you wanted to add?
Yes, I was going to say, so Representative Oberdorf, in our office, for example, if we send a proposal for settlement, we almost always send it with a cover letter that says, "We are serving this proposal for settlement. If you would like to discuss this matter further, please contact us," which is a subtle way of saying, if you want to talk about this, if we can settle this case, the number that we have written doesn't have to be the end-all be-all. And I've seen defendants serve proposals for settlement with a cover letter that says, if you'll give us confidentiality, we'll give you an extra 10 grand. So, like I said in the presentation, a lot of times, in my observation, proposals for settlement are a way to open a conversation. Don't get me wrong. There are lots of times when people serve proposals for settlement because they're trying to set up an entitlement to fees. But even in the circumstances where they're trying to set up an entitlement to fees, if they get the number right, and this is what I think the point Mr. Gillum was making, if they get the number right, it'll be accepted. So,
you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Final question is, if I'm understanding this correctly, based on pretrial interest, if a plaintiff rejects the offer, it's really in their, no pun intended, it's in their interest to extend the trial right? So the costs continue to mount at that point in time?
You're recognized, Ms. Luca, if you'd like to take that one.
So I do, I tell people I'm a nerd for hire. I do appellate work and trial support. I'm not actually one of the trial lawyers, but I see what they do. And I can tell you from their perspective, they're the ones that are spending the money. They're the ones who are writing the checks for the costs. And it's not a cost that's getting, you know, put off. They have to pay the court reporter at the time the cost is incurred, or the expert, or whoever. And if they don't win at trial, they don't get those costs back. So no, from a practical perspective, there, it's not a good idea to run up the costs. And you also, like I said before, run into the fact that at the end of the day, in order to get the costs, they're going to have to submit a list to a judge. And the defense lawyer is going to be allowed to, you know, look at that list line by line and tell the judge that it's too much. So there are, I guess, protections in place to make sure that if a plaintiff's lawyer does have that intention, that it bites them in the behind at the end of the day.
So, Alexander, you're recognized.
Yes, sir. From the trenches, I can tell you, in the cases where there is obvious abuse, and that's not the majority of cases, but in the cases where there is obvious abuse, sometimes once that proposal for settlement has not been accepted, we're off to the races. And it can be expensive to take medical expert depositions, for example, but it's not expensive to take lay witness depositions. And I see many cases where we have numerous depositions that really have a questionable need to be taken. We have discovery that is questionable as to whether it's needed, but I see a lot more activity in the cases where there is what I believe to be obvious abuse. Now, that is not the vast majority of cases, but where there is abuse, the fees and activity regularly get run up. Yes, sir.
Representative Roth, you've been waiting so patiently. You're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. And I have a method to my madness. I want to make sure I don't ask a stupid question. For those of you who don't know that, I'm a farmer, not a lawyer. So I think I may be allowed to have a stupid question because I don't know the answer, right? Trying to boil all this down and come to some balanced approach, if we're talking about making changes in the legislation, Chair, I have a thought.
You have a question, too?
Yeah, the question is, what do you think about the idea of going to 10%, which I think benefits the plaintiff, because that makes the defendant make a higher offer, and then also eliminating the cost, because doesn't eliminating the cost benefit the defendant? So one defendant benefits the plaintiff, and one benefits the defendant. That's my question.
Ms. Luca, you want to take that first? You're recognized if you do.
Yes. So I worry about 10% personally because of that last side about you're making a judgment call and 25% is more forgiving. Yet when, you know, if we're still in a system where the first party insurance claim, my friend whose roof has been crushed and she needs to get it fixed, I think that perhaps the delineation, if you're going to keep the statutes the way that they are for first-party insurance claims, that it would be better to break the PFS statute up depending on who's making the claims, and not who, plaintiff or defendant, but depending on what kind of situation. Because, again, personally, I don't like the idea of removing costs because if the offer is accepted, the costs stop. The costs are a consequence of rejecting the offer. So I don't like the idea of removing costs. And honestly, me personally, if you're asking Megan Peek Luca, 10% scares me. Maybe less than 25, but 10 makes me nervous.
Anyone on this side want to respond? Ms. Gill, you're recognized.
If you don't mind, would you please answer the question? She didn't answer it.
I
asked what if it was a balanced offer. Is there some common sense to the offer?
I will, Representative Roth, but I first want to say, as a son of a fourth-generation farmer whose dad's still on the same ground, I appreciate where you're coming from. I don't think it's as balanced as the way you articulated it for two reasons. I think the 10% factor impacts both defense offers and plaintiff's offers. And so I think it has the same impact on both sides. And the issue of cost, I still think, is being conflated in the discussion here today. There's two issues with cost. One is recoverability of cost, and one is considering costs that are recovered post-judgment in the factor of whether or not you meet the proposal for settlement offer of judgment standard. I mean, we're not saying, I've not suggested, or I hope it didn't come across that way, that I don't think costs should be recoverable in a case. The question is whether or not you would add those costs that are recoverable in to the soup of whether or not someone has met the threshold to win fees. And I'm saying take it out of the calculation because that's where the confusion is caused. I'm not saying someone shouldn't be able to recover a cost if they're a prevailing party. That's a different issue. Does that make sense?
It does.
Thank you.
Representative Daniels, you get the last question. We have 3 minutes left. You're recognized.
I want Mr. Alexander to answer, sir. Is that okay?
Can we move to Daniels and you can get with Mr. Alexander after the panel discussion? Is that fine, Representative Roth? Representative Daniels, you're recognized. Trying to get through a lot of questions, a lot of interest in this
topic. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much. And I would like to ask a question of Ms. Luca. Since the farmer asked a question, I have enough confidence as a preacher to ask a question because probably everybody in here would know the answer to this question, probably but me. So, and you did an excellent presentation. I just want to say that. But you mentioned an offer being reasonable. And what if one side thinks it's reasonable and the other doesn't? Who decides what is reasonable? And that's my question.
Ms. Luca, you're recognized.
The jury. Because, you know, there are some times where you get a $1 offer, and it's because the defense says this case is meritless and I shouldn't have to spend another penny in costs and I shouldn't have to pay my lawyer to defend it. And I'm telling you that I think it's meritless, and if you keep going, I'm going to get all of my costs and all of my fees from the date that I made this offer. And it's going to be up to a jury at that point to decide. Because the plaintiff might look at it and say, I don't think my case is meritless. I think your $1 offer is offensive, and I'm willing to take my chances with a jury. So ultimately, when you're evaluating the offers, a proposal for settlement, an offer of judgment, a demand for judgment, it's a settlement offer. And as lawyers, we are ethically obligated to take it to our client and to explain to our client, this is what it means, and this is how much you would be paying or recovering, and this is your exposure if you reject it. And then at the end of the day, really, it's the client who decides whether they want to offer or whether they want to accept an offer. They do it with the advice of their counsel, and then a jury is going to tell you whether you made the right judgment call or not. Does that answer your question? Because I did not want to evade yours.
Well, unfortunately, all good things must come to an end, and that's this subcommittee. Unfortunately, we're out of time. And this subcommittee, we're going to be working hard and probably extending meetings, but today is not going to be one of those days. But I do really appreciate, it's one of the more intellectual and thought-provoking conversations we've had in front of the subcommittee. We'll see if that results in any legislation. And members, I encourage you to reach out to the panelists, get their contact information, or we can get that to you so you can get whatever information you need from them. But thank you on behalf of the entire subcommittee. Thank you, all four of you. Very, very well done, very good presentations, and a lot of information that this subcommittee can use moving forward. That concludes today's subcommittee meeting. Representative Roth moves we rise. Unless there's an objection upon the motion, Representative Roth, the meeting is adjourned. Happy Thanksgiving.